Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Ever since 9/11, the nation has seen the rise of government power to combat terrorism. But has it gone too far? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. And in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the nation has been at war, not only abroad, but here at home. And in its wake, the Patriot Act was passed by Congress and signed into law, ushering in an era of security measures not seen since the advent of the Cold War. To help us sort all of this out, our guest is Ajmal Qureshi. He is a professor at Howard University Law School, as well as a member of the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we talk a lot about national security and surveillance, detention. Let's go back a ways to those early days after 9/11. How did we get here? What is the origin of the kinds of national security measures that we now seem to be say, proliferating, whether it's detentions, surveillance, a whole host of measures now been taking place. What happened?
Well, I think it all goes back to those days after September 11th, where we were all worried about the state of the nation, and perhaps too hastily, we passed certain laws or allowed certain laws to be passed, which we didn't totally understand the ramifications of. Now, obviously, as many of your listeners and watchers are probably aware, there's been significant debate around the Patriot Act, and we realized that certain provisions of the Patriot Act really were too intrusive. So, for example, the ACLU in the past has litigated successfully provisions of the Patriot Act that allowed people's library records to be looked into and turned over to the federal government. And so, you know, what we're really concerned about now is at the head of the ACLU's attention at this moment is the National Defense Authorization Act, certainly certain provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act, which try to write into a bill from 2001, the authorization for use of military force, new detention provisions that were never really intended to be part of the authorization for use of military force and have dangerous consequences for every American citizen, regardless of where they live, even in America, and their civil rights and civil liberties.
Now, as a matter of fact, in the opening, really sort of days of the era of the war on terrorism, I think it was Dick Cheney who talked about having to go over to the dark side, and that seemed to include detentions as well as obviously enhanced interrogation or torture. Lay out for us how we got those into place. I mean, was this something that we did legally, or was this something that was bootstrapped onto previous laws in order to allow, for instance, for black ops sites and so on, or enhanced interrogation?
So the Bush administration tried to use a number of techniques, many of which were later found to be illegal by the Supreme Court. So obviously, the Bush administration set up Guantanamo Bay. The Bush administration, in coordination with several countries around the world, set up black ops sites where people were sent there and tortured and interrogated in harsh ways. And people were detained for prolonged periods of time without access to challenge their detention or ever prove their actual innocence for the matters that they were actually arrested or detained for. What your listeners and watchers are probably most aware of is sort of the triumvirate of Supreme Court cases that the Supreme Court heard in 2003 and then decided in 2004, having to do with the rights of American citizens detained in Afghanistan and foreign nationals detained in Afghanistan. And in both cases, the Supreme Court was clear that the Bush administration couldn't detain those people indefinitely without sort of giving them some chance to challenge their designation as a terrorist. So certainly a lot of the means that the Bush administration used, whether or not they were torture, whether or not it was extraordinary rendition, whether it was sort of the detention of these people at Guantanamo Bay without the chance to challenge their initial detention, were serious violations of civil rights and civil liberties, and the Supreme Court agreed.
One of the issues that, has arisen, and we've had, for instance, the latest trial from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which is now taking place in Guantanamo before a special commission. This concept, on the one hand, of gathering intelligence, which obviously, in this particularly case of KSM, they utilized enhanced interrogation or torture, obviously waterboarding some 180 some odd times, as I recall. On the one hand, so Dick Cheney and company would say, we had to have this intelligence. This is the ticking bomb. We really need to get after it. On the other hand, that doesn't really set a very good precedent in terms of how you would then litigate, say, any crimes that these people have committed. It seems as if there is this, as if the United States got itself caught in this trap as it moved out from beyond 9/11 and as the war on terrorism and its overall, at least emotional spark, began to disappear.
Precisely. I think not only do the techniques that you mentioned, which I think in the view of most Americans, extended sleep deprivation, extended holding in cold weather, extended use of waterboarding, the pouring of sort of extremely cool liquid on a person's face to simulate the feeling that they were drowning. Most people would feel that those things are torture. And while the Bush administration, you know, didn't define them as such, you know, they used a very stringent standard saying there had to be the danger of death or organ failure. I think most people would say that, you know, that is torture and that undermines American values and American liberties. You know, that's not the sort of country we want to be. You know, I mean, if generally, you know, we reserve torture is something that's done by sort of far-off governments and far-off places, you know, not something that Americans or the American government does. But, you know, in addition to the fact that, you know, it erodes at our American values, it's also, frankly, just as you alluded to in your question, ineffective. You know, it's been shown that when people are tortured, they're less likely to give honest responses. Frankly, they'll just say anything to get the torture to stop. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. They just want to say something to get something out there that will make their oppressors stop torturing them. And the reality is that, you know, once a person has been tortured, the evidence that's gotten as a result of torture often can't be used in the actual trial because that sort of evidence produced through torture is inadmissible. And so not only does it erode at our American values, it doesn't get us the right information, and then it can't really be used in the actual terrorism trials.
Well, as a matter of fact, in the trial of KSM, as I understand it, amongst other things, that there is some coerced evidence is going to be allowed in, at least under this tribunal. But what do you make of that? And is there, I mean, would it be different if, for instance, we were, say, holding it in, say, a civil court or federal court, and obviously the government would then be fearful that if it couldn't use X evidence, then this person who, for instance, KSM, who is alleged to have masterminded 9/11, could very well be set free.
Precisely. I mean, I think that's the precise reason that the Bush administration and now the Obama administration has been so hesitant to try these individuals in regular courts because they knew that the evidence that they could rely on would be much more limited, and thus it would create a danger that persons that they suspected of mass atrocities would go free.
Now, one of the interesting things is we had a change, obviously, of administration. The Obama administration came in. The Bush administration went out. And even in the second part of the Bush administration, the second 4 years, there was a move away from torture, a move away from enhanced interrogation. What kind of break do you see between the Bush administration on the one hand and the Obama administration on the other hand when it comes to these kinds of security measures?
Well, the Obama administration has taken some positive steps. Certainly, we've seen the Obama administration be clear that they want to close Guantanamo Bay. And Guantanamo Bay is certainly, from the ACLU's perspective and many Americans' perspective, a sore shame for Americans because it represents not the freedom and the values that we as a country represent, but also it serves as a recruitment tool to terrorists all over the world. I mean, Osama bin Laden may be dead, but as long as Guantanamo Bay stays open, it serves as a resource and serves as a tool that people who dislike America can use to recruit other people to join terrorist causes. So in that sense, the Obama administration has been very clear that they've tried to close Guantanamo Bay, and we commend them for their efforts in that regard. But at the same time, you know, the ACLU has been very troubled by certain other actions that the Obama administration has taken. Of most recent ilk is sort of the passage in the Obama administration's failure to veto the National Defense Authorization Act, and their provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act that for the first time codify and give the president the power to detain American citizens captured on American soil. So anyone like you or me who's from Salisbury or Washington, D.C. or Montgomery County, where I'm from, you know, to be picked up, to be detained indefinitely and never have the chance to prove their innocence of what they were actually picked up for. You know, the ACLU was hopeful that the Obama administration would have vetoed it, but unfortunately they didn't. While the Obama administration issued a signing statement saying that they wouldn't use those portions of the NDAA on American citizens caught in America, that doesn't limit future administrations that come after the Obama administration. Signing statements are just merely non-binding statements. So certainly, you know, the Obama administration could change their mind, and even if the Obama administration doesn't, you know, a future administration that comes after the Obama administration could use those provisions more broadly.
Now, one of the things that Eric Holder, the Attorney General, has said in terms of due process, he has said due process and judicial process are not one and the same, particularly when it comes to national security. The Constitution guarantees due process, not judicial process. And part of that statement was in reference certainly to the drone activity that we've seen, which drones in which they are utilized to kill terrorists. And indeed, some Americans wind up at the other end of that. What about that concept that due process and judicial process are not one and the same thing?
I think that's a scary concept. I mean, so we're saying that in the national security context, suddenly, you know, due process doesn't give you the right to a trial, or due process doesn't give you a right to know if the specific charges against you. All it guarantees you, apparently, under the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, is to know that someone has accused you of being a terrorist. You know, it's a scary thought to know that suddenly anyone like you or me or our families or our friends could suddenly, you know, under Eric Holder's, in this case, his definition of due process under this particular statement, we wouldn't have the right to actually challenge our detentions. You know, it leads to the question of what next. You know, what other, you know, dangerous crimes or, in the view of the administration, dangerous situations will allow us to be detained without trial?
Is there precedent for this concept that due process does not necessarily mean a judicial process or a judicial review?
Due process is generally based on the circumstances of the individual case and the individual situation. So normally, you know, from a legal perspective, there are different factors that you take into consideration when deciding, you know, what the appropriate amount of due process would be. But I certainly would think that an American citizen who's captured in America, you know, should have at a minimum the right to prove their innocence as opposed to being indefinitely held by the military.
Now, what about the use, for instance, of drones, which are utilized to kill suspected terrorists? Obviously, amongst those can be an American who may very well be involved, say, for instance, with say, Al-Qaeda or some terrorist group. What kind of guarantee? What kind of guarantee is there for an American not to have that happen to him or her, if she indeed is affiliated? I mean, there's no due process there, as the intelligence operation says, and the intelligence service says, this person is a terrorist, and therefore he is then subject, or she is subject then, to this attack, which obviously there's no due process at all.
Sure, and that's very different from the situation that we're talking about with regards to the National Defense Authorization Act. I mean, the situation that you're talking about is on, you know, what everyone would agree is the quote-unquote traditional battlefield. But, you know, I don't think that anyone would think that, you know, the streets of Chicago where Jose Padilla was picked up and then detained indefinitely without charge. He was an American citizen who was picked up in Chicago and eventually later on convicted for a separate, less serious terrorism crime than that, than the one he was actually picked up with. No one would say the streets of Chicago are a battlefield. But what the NDAA does is that it extends the powers of the president to detain somebody indefinitely without charge, without trial, from only the battlefield, which you discussed, to you know, any city, any home, any street in America.
It does seem to me, though, that it indicates that we are sitting in this sort of twilight conflict, because we're not involved with a war against a particular state. There may not be an end in sight for some time, and that these sort of under ordinary circumstances, even if, say, for instance, there was a criminal who was sought, say, for instance, in another country, would seek, for instance, extradition, for example. But instead, we are kind of trapped in this one hand where we have this sort of war. And all of the parameters that go with it. On the other hand, you're talking about, for instance, detaining somebody who is connected to this war and yet then trying to apply, for instance, civil or legal or criminal standards to them. I mean, there just does seem to be this sort of gray area that we're now sitting in.
Right. But I would say that, you know, Congress has spoken to this precise issue. I mean, I think that after the Civil War, when, you know, there was a lot of this blending, I think American citizens and Americans in general were concerned that this not happen again. So they passed, you know, what's called the Posse Comitatus Act. And what the Posse Comitatus Act says is that, you know, the military cannot be involved in domestic law enforcement. So there are certain boundaries that we've put on that gray to sort of prevent the gray from extending too far, per se. And one of those is the Posse Comitatus Act. And what we see with the NDAA allowing the indefinite detention of Americans caught in America, American citizens caught in America, is, you know, a potential violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, because you would have these American citizens, once they were captured, being held in military custody under the NDAA.
So how do you see the courts then reacting to the NDAA? I mean, in terms of its ability, particularly the use of military folks in order to, say, detain someone. I mean, what has been the record of the Supreme Court, and especially this particular court, especially with the departure, for instance, somebody like Sandra Day O'Connor, who was seen as a moderate, as opposed, say, some of the replacements that come afterwards during the Bush administration?
Well, I think that... you know, the Supreme Court has been clear, whether it was in Rasool, which had to do with a foreign national captured in Afghanistan, saying that he had a habeas corpus right to sort of challenge his detention, or whether it was in Hamdi, which had to do with an American citizen captured in Afghanistan, saying that he had the right to an impartial judge to contest his designation as an enemy combatant, or whether it was in Hamdan, in which the Supreme Court in 2006 said that the trial mechanisms that were being used at Guantanamo Bay at that time to try individuals did not comply with the Geneva Conventions nor the United States Uniform Code for Military Justice. So the Supreme Court's been clear that, you know, there are these certain benchmarks that protect Americans and protect American values. And, you know, it's our strong belief that had the Supreme Court had the chance to consider the issue with Jose Padilla, in which, you know, he was picked up on American soil and was an American citizen, they would have come out the same way. However, before the Supreme Court could address the merits of the issue, the Bush administration did charge Jose Padilla. So the issue never got to the Supreme Court. But given the Supreme Court's records in the last decade in regards to these types of cases, there is significant reason to believe that the Supreme Court would agree with the ACLU, as well as numerous individuals besides the ACLU who've spoken about the potential unconstitutionality and the potential unconstitutional effect of the NDAA. You know, I haven't mentioned it yet, but you know, the ACLU is not the only party that's objected to the NDAA. It's been objected to by 23 different generals from both sides of the aisles. It was objected to by the Pentagon's general counsel, Jay Johnson, you know, two generals actually wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying that the NDAA and those provisions of the NDAA that we've discussed today not only weaken American values, but hurt America in the war on terror.
Well, some critics of the Obama administration have said that essentially that they see a continuation of the Bush policies into the Obama administration. I mean, even somebody as Vice President Dick, former Vice President Dick Cheney says of Obama, he says he's learned that what we did was far more appropriate than ever gave us credit for while he was a candidate. Jack Balkin, who's a Yale law professor, talks about how that there is this sort of continuation, as it were, of this policy that, or then this trend that you talk about in the Bush administration into the Obama administration. Do you see it that way? Do you see some people have suggested there's a bipartisan support now for this kind of approach to terrorism and to national security measures?
Well, I mean, certainly there are dangerous signs of continuation. As I mentioned before, the Obama administration has been consistent in their criticism of Guantanamo Bay and their desire to close Guantanamo Bay. But I want to say that there are voices in Congress that have been steadfast in their efforts to limit the effects of the NDAA and other problematic provisions. For example, Morris Udall tried to introduce an amendment which would have limited the effect of the NDAA. Right now, or even before it was passed, Senator Leahy from Vermont spoke about the potential dangerous effect of the NDAA. Carl Levin from Michigan spoke about the potential dangerous effect of the NDAA. And now there's something pending in Congress called the Smith Amendment, again introduced by Congressman Smith, that would limit the potential effect of the NDAA. So there is some degree of continuation, as you accurately point out. But I think there are voices who are speaking for American values in Congress also.
There are voices in Congress that are speaking out against such measures. On the other hand, is that enough of a pushback? I mean, the kind of sound that I hear coming from Congress tends to be just in the opposite direction. I mean, obviously, you point out a moment ago, they approved the NDAA. Well, I mean, that's, you know, what are we to make of this idea that perhaps, whether it's politics or whether it's just simply what they believe, there seems to be a bipartisan constituency and support for these kinds of national security measures?
Well, I think what we're supposed to make of it is we're supposed to become more involved as citizens and push our Congress members to address the issues that we're concerned about. I think, you know, it's up to us as a citizenry to tell Congress when we think they've gone too far. You know, I mean, I think, you know, there's a I forget his name at this moment, but there's a constitutional law professor at Harvard who's written a book, you know, We the People, I believe it's Bruce Ackerman, who talks about the role that we all have in interpreting the Constitution, that constitutional interpretation is not just for the courts, not just for the presidency, and not just for Congress, but that it's also a role that needs to be played by the American people. And so certainly to the extent that, you know, what you say is truth, you know, what we need to do, we need to be interpreters of the Constitution and make sure the Constitution stands up to American values and push to make sure that our representatives reflect those values in the future.
How successful, though, do you think those kinds of efforts will be, given the sort of the endless nature of this war on terrorism? I mean, Osama bin Laden is dead, and yes, we are sort of pulling back, or at least supposed to begin to draw back down from Afghanistan. We'll see what the next presidential election certainly holds in that form. But even with that beginning to draw down, it does seem as if the war on terrorism and those who, for instance, are associated with Al-Qaeda, who declare themselves terrorists, whatever definition you want to use, are still going to be out there for quite some time to come, perhaps regroup in other fashions other than Al-Qaeda. I mean, that threat now seems to be almost eternal. I suppose, for instance, an individual country, a system, you know, we had the Soviet Union for some 70 years and it finally disappeared. You really see that? I mean, in this kind of climate that we have, do you really think that there's that kind of public support to roll back some of these security measures?
I think there is. I think that, you know, what we saw after the Patriot Act was 400 different communities came forward and passed resolutions saying that they opposed certain problematic provisions of the Patriot Act. And I think the same way that people stepped up then. No one's saying that, you know, there isn't a danger out there to us. It's just, you know, whether or not we need to sort of use measures which, you know, wear away at due process as part of the war on terror. Measures that, you know, people who are involved in the fight of the, in the war on terror have said, again, are unnecessary. You know, it would be one thing if, you know, again, if the ACLU is the only one saying these matters, but it says something that, you know, the people who are doing the fighting in the war on terror themselves say some of these measures go too far.
Turning to another aspect of this, we have obviously the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, which is now moving through Congress, basically allows private firms to hand over personal information about users to law enforcement and security agencies. I mean, this includes not only internet providers, telecom companies, wireless providers. Are you concerned about that expansion that we see taking place? I mean, we began early with a lot of warrantless wiretaps and so on during the Bush administration. Seems as if we're now moving, expanding again and utilizing, as it were, the private sector to, say, for instance, to do the work that perhaps, say, a law enforcement agency could not do simply because it would need, say, for instance, a warrant.
Sure. I mean, certainly, I think the main concern that comes up in that context is increasingly we've come to rely on a variety of databases to do our law enforcement. And oftentimes, what we find is that those databases are in error. So to the extent that we try to push away from traditional law enforcement, you know, the traditional, you know, beat cop work and more just try to sort of check, you know, whether or not somebody is in a certain database for one thing or another, you know, it raises the danger that somebody could be inherently marked in a different database. I specialize in local enforcement of federal immigration law, and one of what we've seen is the increased use of databases in that specific context. The one that's most well known in that context is something called E-Verify. It's an employment verification database, in which it relies as an employment verification check system, which relies on the Social Security Administration database. And as the Office of Inspector General within the government itself has found, is that the Social Security Administration database is horribly flawed. And that oftentimes people will come up being told they're not employed to work when in fact that's actuality and error. So certainly I think that to the extent that electronic verification is more a part of enforcement work, it is a danger.
Also, it does seem as if, just briefly, that it's also utilized in an effort to prevent something from happening, which is a much different proposition than what we are considered, say, traditional crime, for instance, gathering, in which we're now looking at something that's actually occurred. I mean, does that sort of create this incentive to utilize these kinds of data information gathering systems, which is so we're trying to prevent something? And in the process of obviously trying to prevent something, we look at lots of people who have nothing to do with what we're trying to prevent.
Sure. I mean, I hate to go all sort of Steven Spielberg on you, but, you know, I mean, it sort of brings up this Minority Report question. You know, one of the basic principles of criminal law that sort of all first-year law students learn is that for you to be convicted of attempt, you can't be enough that you just thought of the attempt in your mind or that you told somebody else you were thinking of some sort of attempt. You have to sort of actually take some sort of active steps towards actually perpetuating the crime that you actually want to commit. So, I mean, I certainly believe that preventative measures are good and a useful technique. It's just that, you know, we don't want to get into a situation where, you know, we're going so far that a person hasn't even taken that first step towards committing the crime. Again, the danger there would be is, you know, we're going to be relying on faulty information and pulling in people more like thought police than actually the seasoned law enforcement officers that we have in our police departments.
We've been speaking with Ajmal Qureshi. He's a professor at Howard University Law School, also a member of the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.